All right. Welcome again to everyone to Great Decisions, Part 9, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilan Ishra Siona ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Tonight we'll discuss the very controversial, very trying debate over reparations. First introduction, the War of Independence, Milchemet HaShichrur, was brutal. It was prolonged. But ultimately successful. The casualty rate was astonishing. 1% of all Jews in Israel at the time were killed in battle. That's over 6,000 people. Just take 1% of the population, you know, in an American context, whether it's World War I or World War II, you're talking millions of people killed. And the war included some moments when vital interests were threatened. Just 2 weeks after Yom HaTzmut, the old city of Yerushalayim fell, most Jews were taken captive, and the new city was encircled by Arabs and was under siege, the new city. Several times Israel tried to flee, to free the road to Yerushalayim by capturing Latrun from the Arab Legion, and they failed each time. The second most heartrending, Jews straight from the internment camps, most of them survivors of the Holocaust, most not even speaking Hebrew, were given rifles and essentially just told to charge across the plain. It's a long and flat plain, and many were just mowed down, and others just fled the battlefield. Without training and without sufficient manpower, the battle was hopeless. Now, of course, the Highway 1 cuts right through it, and it looks very bucolic, but it was a scene of tremendous carnage in 1948. Yerushalayim itself was in danger of being captured, and Ben-Gurion ordered reinforcements sent there, which he didn't do in other places, to hold Yerushalayim at all costs. By the first ceasefire in June, the Egyptians were close to Beersheba and threatening kibbutzim in the Negev. The Syrians were in the Galil and attacking Degania, and the Arab Legion had taken Ramat Rachel just south of Yerushalayim. In June, the Latrun Road was bypassed. The famous Burma Road was paved, a path through the mountains southwest of Yerushalayim. It's a very well-known, well-trod hiking trail today, and the city was liberated. During the first ceasefire, and despite the Altalena debacle, Israel was able to regroup and rearm and prepare, launching an attack on the Egyptians right when the ceasefire ended in July. One operation called Mitsa Mavet La Polesh, Operation Death to the Invader, which, you know, certainly more understandable than the recent names given operations. We can only long for the good old days. You know, what does cast lead mean? What's pillar of defense? Operation Death to the Invader, right? That sounds like they know what they're doing. Followed by others. Eventually, the Egyptians were repelled. The settlements in the western Negev were linked up with Israel. The Syrians driven from the Galil. Lod and Ramla were captured in this period of time, creating somewhat of a buffer west of Yerushalayim. Even though Israel failed in five tries to capture Latrun, that would wait for the Six-Day War. After a second ceasefire, and after Abdullah refused to allow Israel any territory on the Gulf, in the south, a race to Umrashrash, a little Arab shanty town, resulted in Israel claiming sovereignty over that area on March 10, 1949, today known to us as the city of Eilat. Now, the war was marked by heavy casualties, by internal disputes involving strategy, allocation of resources, control over the military. Ben-Gurion resigned in a huff at one point, only to be persuaded to stay. Before the war, the Jewish forces were split without a central command, and not just in terms of the underground, but even within the Haganah. It took time for that central command to take effect and for people to respond to it. As you well know, the Jewish people are a nation of prime ministers and generals. Every one of us has an opinion, and sometimes more than one. There are a number of immediate consequences to independence. In early 1949, armistice agreements were signed with Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, negotiated at Rhodes and over the course of several months. With the war over, governance had to begin. Israel's first elections were held on January 25th, 1949. Ben-Gurion's Mapai won 46 seats. Mapam, the far-left Mapam, won 19, but being pro-Soviet, they refused to join the coalition, which gained its majority by co-opting what was called the Religious Front at 16 seats. The first, one of the few times, it really ended within a decade, that Mizrahi and Aguda would run together. By the 50s, that would stop. You know, just by contrast, it's fascinating. In the incoming Knesset, there are 38 Shomrei Shabbos, Shomrei Mitzvahs. 38 out of 140. Almost a third. 120, rather. Almost a third. It's a far cry from the early days, and really represented probably, I think, in five different parties. And a smaller party as well joined, made a coalition. Begin's Chayrut won 14 seats, but Ben-Gurion had sworn never to allow the revisionists or the communists into any of his government. On May 11, 1949, the United Nations declared Israel to be, I quote, a peace-loving state. Peace-loving state, pretty quaint in retrospect, and admitted Israel to the family of nations. I think it was the last time they declared Israel to be a peace-loving state. Of course, UN admission has been a mixed blessing. Later that year, the UN began discussing the internationalization of Yerushalayim, and it was at that point, December 1949, that Ben-Gurion ordered the government to be moved to Yerushalayim from Tel Aviv, and immediately, in order to stake a claim to it, Moshe Sharet, who was the foreign minister at the UN, then to deal with this very issue, resigned in protest because it was a slap in the face to the UN, but as was the custom, Ben-Gurion simply disregarded his resignation. Eventually, all the ministries were relocated to Yerushalayim except for defense, the thinking being that it's best to have Israel's command structure away from a border. And Yerushalayim was a border town. So the Ministry of Defense was then where it is today, in Akiryab, between the Ayalon Freeway and the beach. Apparently, Yerushalayim is still a border town, according to some. The foreign ministry, because of Sharet's refusal, did not move to Yerushalayim until 1953 at Ben-Gurion's insistence. What's interesting is that the Yerushalayim internationalization plan was abandoned by the United Nations, not because of Ben-Gurion or the Israelis, but because of King Abdullah of Jordan, who liked his conquest and said he's not leaving. So in fact, we benefited from his intransigence. Abdullah, nonetheless, was murdered in Al-Aqsa in July 1951 by an Arab radical. Today we call him an Islamist or a Muslim. The politics was one problem. There were other problems, or challenges rather than problems. Primary among them, after 19 centuries, the gates of Eretz Yisrael was fully open to the Jewish people. 100,000 Jews came to Israel before the end of 1948, meaning 16% was added to the population within just a half year. Within 4 years, the population had more than doubled. It was unprecedented growth, especially for a fledgling country. Many immigrants were housed in old British army camps or deserted Arab villages or tent cities, ma'barot, transit camps that contained tin shacks. In some places, hundreds of people shared one shower. In one place, it was one toilet for 56 people. Think about it, a family of, you know, five or six that has just one bathroom struggles with tension. Imagine 56 people trying to share one bathroom. Conditions were very Spartan and especially unpleasant in the summer and the winter. It was rampant unemployment and poverty and loss of dignity. And as is well known, Mizrahi children, Medora Mizrah, were in large numbers taken from their parents and robbed of their heritage, taught that the Torah was obsolete, had their payas cut off, and three generations of dysfunction was spawned. That attitude eventually led to Begin's victory and to the creation of Shas. The main problem was money. There was austerity, rationing, real poverty in Israel. Israel had little industry, no economy to speak of. They were implementing a socialist infrastructure, and they had very few means to support the burgeoning population. In September 1950, Ben-Gurion asked American Jewish leaders to secure a $1 billion loan from America and world Jewry. It didn't happen, but that became the State of Israel bonds. And in May 1951, Ben-Gurion flew to New York, the big gala kickoff at Madison Square Garden of the Israel Bonds Campaign. The hope was for $1 billion. Their expectations were much less, of course. In 1952, in the first year, $52 million was raised for Israel Bonds, double what they expected, but still far short of what Israel needed to jumpstart its economy. A new source of revenue would be needed. And that brings us to our clips. First, we'll look at one that deals with the immigration to Israel, and secondly, a shorter one that touches directly on the reparations debate. And we begin.
Following the establishment of the state, apart from winning the war, was the absorption of hundreds of thousands of immigrants into the country. One has to remember that the number of Jewish population on the eve of statehood was 650,000. Within 3 years, this population doubled. You had to supply them with food, housing, work. It was almost impossible.
The basic institutions of the pre-state and the early state were formed in the image of welfare state socialism. And in my view, this was exactly right for what Israel needed in its early years.
The first wave of immigrants came from the BP camps in Europe and the British detention camps in Cyprus. They were followed by the whole Jewish community from Bulgaria and refugees from Turkey, Romania, Hungary, and Poland. They were settled in any available housing in the cities, towns, and villages. The second wave of immigrants were refugees from Middle Eastern Arab countries. Of the 850,000 who left Arab lands, approximately 600,000 settled in Israel. By the end of the decade, the Jewish population had reached an astounding 2.5 million, meaning the population had quadrupled in only 10 years.
The second wave could not be accommodated, and the result was that we had the establishment of absorption camps, and then what we call ma'abarot, namely a place where there was very minimal housing, but people were already supposed to go and find work.
There wasn't enough food. We went on rations. People came penniless, homeless, traumatized. Most of them did not speak Hebrew. They had lived as Arabic speakers for 2,000 or 1,500 years. Many thousands with all sorts of medical issues. Israel took in the remnants of the rejects of Europe. And made them citizens.
These operations not only cost a lot of money that the government did not have, but also demanded an infrastructure that the country still did not have. And the result was that people stayed in the camps and ma'abarot for long years to live in destitution and in minimal conditions.
my grandparents came to the country, and they lived in Mabara, in a poor barrack made out of tin. It was like a refrigerator in the winter and like a furnace in the summer. Miserable, but they accepted it. They said, well, we came to the Holy Land. But then everybody was like that. Better to lower the standard of living of all of us than leave persecuted Jews outside, because you cannot absorb them.
Okay, of course, I want to thank Rabbi Wein of the Destiny Foundation for their permission to use the clip. I wanted to show one more shorter clip. You could keep the lights off for now.
I'm sorry, what's the name of the woman?
If I remember correctly, it's Professor Shapira from Tel Aviv University. Maybe her name will appear in a caption.
Across the Jewish world, the Holocaust and the State of Israel became two new rallying points for Jewish identity. When the state was established, Jewish organizations worldwide raised critical funds for Israel's fledgling economy. In 1951, German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer offered material reparations to the Jewish people and the State of Israel as penance for its crimes against Jews during the war.
We had the debate about the reparations from Germany, which turned into a fierce struggle between opponents and supporters. The opponents claimed that this is letting down the memory of Holocaust victims, and somebody said, we are ready to accept money as a token for our blood. But the truth is that the reparations money was one of the features that allowed Israel to survive during the 50s from the economic point of view, otherwise the country would go bankrupt.
Israel's infrastructure, including the national water carrier system, the electric grid, highway improvement programs, steel production, the railway system, and other projects were all subsidized in part by German goods and financial help.
It is amazing, not wanting a repeat situation that occurred after the 1914-1918 war, America now poured trillions of dollars into post-1945 Germany. So in effect, the American largesse helped Germany finance the building of Israel by using American money to pay for its reparations. It is not the first time in Jewish history that the Lord has provided different conduits to help save the Jewish people.
Okay, you'll notice that Professor Shapira, when she spoke, talked of reparations as a necessity, as indispensable for the development of the economy and the sustenance of the state. She didn't make a moral argument, and that's part of the issue that has to be framed. That was the background for the reparations dispute. It wasn't initially, in its conception, designed just as an act of penance on Germany's part. A little misleading. The Israelis were the ones who saw it, just like the Allies had also claimed reparations for Germany, just like they did after World War One. After World War Two, it was the exact same thing. But the background was the need to settle all these refugees and find some source of revenue for the Israeli government. It was quite a controversy. I found an article written in an Israeli magazine called Sikur Mimukad, Focused Investigation, about the argument, and the subtitle is Lo Retzach Rabin, Lo Milchemet Yom Kippur, U Betach Lo Itnakut, not Rabin's murder, nor the Yom Kippur War, nor even the expulsion from Gaza, were as severe to the Israeli public, Mikudat Hashever Kashabi Otebe Todat Hamdinat Hachashakvar, Arbashin Machar Kamata. The breaking point that almost split the people apart were none of those other events, but happened 4 years after the state's establishment, and this is the kuach the argument, the debate concerning reparations. The only time the nation actually verged on the brink of civil war, despite all the things that came afterwards, and pitched battles were fought in the street, it was somewhat underplayed in the clip, the Knesset itself was attacked. The issues were emotional, but more than that as well. The wounds of the Holocaust had not yet healed. They'd not even be dressed. There are hundreds of thousands of survivors in Israel still coming to grips with what had happened to them, to the murder of their families. There was pride. There were raw emotions. There was hatred of Germany. There was no interest in forgiveness. On March 12, 1951, as the Allies had already claimed reparations from Germany, Israel submitted a claim for $1.5 billion to the four powers, the Allied powers, that then ruled Germany, the Americans, the Soviets, the British, and the French. They refused to deal with it. They just rejected it. And the matter was referred to the German government. German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer, interesting, that was not him in the picture, but Adenauer offered to pay reparations to the State of Israel as representatives of the victims. Now, Adenauer is an interesting character. He wasn't a Nazi. In fact, the Nazis had dismissed him as the mayor of Cologne. But nor was he vociferously anti-Nazi. He was imprisoned a few times, but he seemed to have spent most of the war years in seclusion. He was elected chancellor in the first German elections after the Holocaust, so he had no role in the Holocaust and was acceptable, therefore, to Western leaders, but he apparently knew of ex-Nazis in government and did little about them. In fact, he had one of his agents secretly try to influence the prosecution at the Eichmann trial, fearing that Eichmann would expose living Nazis still active in Germany and thereby embarrass the German government. But one thing is certain, Adenauer, for whatever reason, and we can assume good motivations, supported Israel and made his commitment to compensate the victims. So what were the two sides? Why take money from them? Why not take money from them? Ben-Gurion's argument, as initially raised, was straightforward. I quote, "In a single sentence, the reason lay in the final injunction of the inarticulate 6 million, the victims of Nazism, whose very murder was a ringing cry for Israel to rise, to be strong and prosperous, to safeguard her peace and security, and so prevent such a disaster from ever again overwhelming the Jewish people." Now, that was the contention in Ben-Gurion's authorized biography, and in retrospect, it was not the strong argument. There was a better one to make that he would employ later. It was a bad argument because it assumed that the State of Israel should be the natural recipient of compensation on behalf of the victims, because that is what the victims would have wanted. Well, says who? Not only were many Holocaust victims not Zionists, but right at the end of this debate, not long after, there would be the first public exposure of the involvement of the Zionist establishment in a small part of the Holocaust, the relationship of Rudolf Kastner with Adolf Eichmann. Kastner, in 1953, was a Mapai official. During the war, he'd been a Zionist leader in Hungary. The accusation was made publicly that Kastner had purposely not warned Hungarian Jewry of their impending deportations, 1944, in order to facilitate his escape and those of his friends and family and others, 1,700 all, to Switzerland. So he was accused, in effect, of being a collaborator. Kastner sued for libel, and he lost. The judge ruling, I quote, it's a famous quotation in the annals of Israel, Kastner had sold his soul to the devil. But even before the public accusation, obviously many Israelis knew, the Europeans knew, and knew what the Zionist establishment had done and not done during the Holocaust. It's a little hard to digest the claim that the dying words of the 6 million were that Israel should rise, be strong and prosperous. That's not quite synonymous with Animam in Bevi HaMashiach. Nonetheless, in December, Ben-Gurion asked Nachum Goldman, who spoke about last time, then head of the World Jewish Congress, to meet with Adenauer, sound him out on specifics, and propose that $1 billion be the starting point of negotiations. Interestingly, other groups became involved in their desire for reparations. It was at that time that Goldman co-founded with others the Claims Conference. Memorial claims for material compensation from Germany still exists. So it wasn't just the Israeli government, and in the end, reparations would also go to survivors. On December 6th in London, Adenauer agreed, signed the memorandum that $1 billion would be the baseline for negotiations, and that would enable negotiations to start. So Adenauer informed the German parliament of what was happening, and I quote, "The federal government is prepared, jointly with representatives of Jewry and the State of Israel, to bring about a solution to the material indemnity problem, thus easing the way to the spiritual settlement of infinite suffering." It was then, in December, late December 1951, that Ben-Gurion brought the matter to the cabinet and the Knesset, and pandemonium broke loose. In the Knesset, Ben-Gurion made a better argument, amounting to Haratzachta v'gam yarashta, were you going to murder and also inherit? And he said as follows, before, during, and after this systematic mass murder came the pillage, this too on an unprecedented scale. A crime of such enormous proportions can have no material compensation. Any compensation of whatever size is no restitution for the loss of human life or expiation for the sufferings and agonies of men and women, children, old people, and infants. However, even after the defeat of the Hitler regime, the German people continues to enjoy the fruits of that massacre and pillage, of the plunder and robbery of the Jews who were murdered. The government of Israel considers itself bound to demand of the German people restitution for the stolen German property. Let not the murderers of our people also be the beneficiaries of its property. Haratzachta v'gam yorashta. And that's a much more compelling argument than the first one that was made, where simply stating we need the money and therefore they are a source of money. The main opponent, of course, was Menachem Begin, but it's very interesting that the division in the government, even in the Knesset and in Israeli society, was not according to party lines. And the votes would be very close. So the right-wing Chayrut was unalterably opposed, but so too was the far left-wing Mapam. Mapam was composed in large part of former partisans who hated Germany and could not bear to take what they called blood money from the Germans. And for sure, Adenauer was also looking to rehabilitate Germany's reputation in the world, detaching the new Germany from the old Nazi Germany. Mapai was not necessarily the party of survivors, because Mapai consisted, Ben-Gurion's party consisted of people come up through the ranks. To come up through the ranks almost inevitably meant you did not suffer in the Holocaust. You had to be in Israel already for decades. One Mapamnik suspected this would lead to a Nazi takeover of Germany. Another said they would never pay the money and their crimes would be forgiven. Golda Meir was for it before she was against it, and then she was for it again, stating that to her, every German is a future Nazi German. But then she changed her mind also. Now, Begin had partially withdrawn from public life after the 1951 elections gave Chayrut only 8 seats. Only 8. But now he appeared again in Yerushalayim. That day was early January. He had himself sworn in again as a member of Knesset. He hadn't bothered because his party was so small. On January 7th, 1952, while Ben-Gurion was speaking in the Knesset, which was then located on King George Street, Rehov HaMelech George and Beit Frumin, you could still see it. It's between Ben Yehuda and where the Red Heifer restaurant is, a gray building, which has a little shell up, a little sign in front, saying this is the seat of the very first Knesset. So if you imagine the scene when Ben-Gurion was speaking in the Knesset, Begin led a rally in Kikar Tzion at the foot of Ben Yehuda that drew thousands of people, And there he spoke powerful words straight from the heart. Remember Begin, his father, his mother, his brother were all murdered in the Holocaust. So he stood over a banner on the roof of a hotel in Kikar Tzion. The banner read, "Kvodenu lo yimacher bekesev," our honor will not be sold for money. "Dameinu lo yichupar b'scharot," our blood will not be atoned for with goods. "Nimchet acherpa," we will erase the humiliation. And he gave a speech I tracked down. I'll read it in Hebrew because it's powerful. I'll translate also. One of his most emotional speeches, if not the most in his life. "Bnei Yerushalayim, Ezrachei Yisrael," children of Yerushalayim, citizens of Israel, "Ha'erev omeid l'krot ha'mikra ha'machpir b'yoteh b'toldot ha'meinu," tonight we're about to see the unfolding of the most humiliating chapter in the history of our people. "B'sham marazah," this bitter time, "navil neged ruchenu et avoteinu akadoshim, imoteinu atvuchot." At this time we should put before our mind's eye our holy fathers, our slaughtered mothers, "v'tinokotenu," and our infants, "shehuvlu b'milyonim latevach," that were brought by the millions to the slaughter, "al yedei ha-satan sheyatza mitachtit ha-geonom le'achriv et sheirit amenu," by the Satan that came from the depths of Gehenna to destroy the remnant of our people. And he says there's no nation as cruel in their wickedness, in the abomination that they perpetrated, then the miratzchim agermanim, the German murderers, "et avi hazaken," my elderly father, "yachad im 500 yudei brisk," together with 500 men from Brisk, "hotzio on ahar v'tivum sham," they took them out to the river and drowned them all, "narot tmimot nikberu chayim ki rashem lamato," innocent girls were buried alive with their heads down, "tinokot," infants, "nikru mizrot imotem," they were torn from the arms of their mothers, "v'nishluchu kivshanesh," and thrown into the furnace, "lo hereg bilvadi akana," it wasn't just murder, it was a gross mockery, it was unprecedented barbarism, "ma'asa asha'ein milim b'fianos l'terat omek hazvah," deeds that words cannot begin to describe the depth of the horror, "she'ein l'taktim b'story," has no precedent in history. And he says, "v'nei yom hazeh," behold, on this day, "arba shanim l'achar t'chalta d'geula," interesting is the phrase, 4 years after the beginning of the redemption, "omed rosh ha'memshla evri," the Hebrew prime minister stands and tells us, "ki le'yelech le'germania b'chdei l'kabel kesef," he's going to Germany in order to receive money, "ki yelech ba'ad betza kesef," for some profit, "l'mkar et kvod am Yisrael ulatil lav chepat ad," for a little money he's going to trade, going to sell the honor of the Jewish people and to place on us eternal shame. "Lachein ani omer l'adon Ben-Gurion," therefore I say to Mr. Ben-Gurion, "Lo ya masal matanim Germania," there'll be no negotiations with Germany. "Al zanachnu kulanu muchanim m'sort nafshenu," for that we are all willing to give our lives. "Yehareg ubal yavor," better to be killed than to allow this to take place. "Ein karbana shalona kriv b'chdei l'sakel mizimazo," there's no sacrifice that we won't make in order to impede this initiative. And then he took a note from his pocket, or someone handed him a note on top of this hotel before this crowd of thousands, and he said that he just received this. "L'fi yidiyot shekibalu zata," we just received information that Ben-Gurion's forces have rimonim, hand grenades, "v'gazim madmiim," and tear gas mitotzeret Germania, that his police forces are carrying grenades and tear gas may canisters made in Germany. Otam gazim shechnikot avoteinu, the same gas that strangled our fathers. Yeshua bate soar machanot rikuz, he has jails planned, concentration camps planned for us. And now we really declared war in a way he never did before and never did again after that. He said, Kasher yiritembi batotach, when you fired on me with the cannon at the Altalena just 4 years earlier, natati etapkuda, I gave the order, lo, no, don't respond. Hayom etenet apkuda, today I'll give the order, Cain, yes. Now we will respond. Amnam lo tedu rachamim aleinu. We know you'll show no mercy on us. Ach zot apam lo nedar rachamim gam klapechem. This time we'll show no mercy towards you either. Zot tiyeh milchama lechayim al hamavet. This will be a war of life and death. Leman Hashem, in God's name. Aritzim atumei lev, you arrogant ones with a stopped up heart. Chusu al ha'am hazeh, take pity on this nation, b'terem tipatach ha'ra'ah, before the evil begins. And he says one last paragraph, anachnu lo tachni, otanu lo tachni, you will not force us to bend. Ki ein koch ba'olam shi'achni et koch ha'elei ha'etzel, there's no force in the world that can cause the forces of the Irgun to capitulate. Interesting, because the Irgun had been out of existence now for 4 years already. Hayom azani modia lachem, today I inform you, ki lo tiod memshal yudit, there will not be a Jewish government. Velo tiod lachem azchut amusarit b'Yisrael, there will not be the ethical right to rule in Israel. Memshalah zo, this government, that will open up negotiations with the murderers, the destroyers of our people, it'll be an evil government that bases its rule on the bayonet and the hand grenade. Tell the Jewish police officers, Gamata Yudi, you're also a Jew. Ein lanu efsharut maskim lazeh. There's no chance that you would agree to this. So al tarimu yad, don't lift a hand against Jews. Ki einanu milchamim alechem, we're not fighting over bread. Einanu milchamim neged titzuv, we're not fighting for budgets, for money. Rather, al nishmata muchvado umau anu milchamim. We're fighting for the soul of our people, for the honor of our nation. Narim kulanu yad, we'll all lift our hands v'nishba b'shem Yerushalayim and swear in the name of Yerushalayim, b'shem Leag Ardom, those who went to the gallows, b'shem Zev Jabotinsky, b'meshkache cherpat ha'shmada, if we forget the shame of the extermination, tishkach yimini, let my right hand be forgotten, tidbak l'shoni l'chikim lo'ezkerena, let my tongue cleave to its palate, if we don't remember, imlo alech cherpat hashmada barosh yigoni, if we don't raise the humiliation of the extermination at the top of our sorrow. B'nei Yerushalayim l'maracha, to the battlefields. Al kvod Yisrael batido, for the honor of Israel and its future. Ko yitein v'ko yosef elokei Yisrael, a pasuk from the Navi. This is what God has commanded us to do. To Menachem Begin, this was the ultimate abomination that reeked of all the slanders that Jew haters had heaped upon Jews for centuries, that Jews only care about money, they would sell their souls and their pride for money. Even the Holocaust was about money. In the Knesset that day, Elimelech Rimmel, who was a member of Knesset from the General Zionist Party, said that his young son asked him innocently, how much money can we get for Sab and Safta, who had been killed? What price will they fetch? How much are they worth? With that, he completed his speech. Begin led this throng of Jews by the thousands to Knesset on Rehov Melech George, which had been ringed with barbed wire. They were met by hundreds of police with batons, shields, gas masks, and tear gas as well. The whole street was cordoned off from Rehov Yafo to Kikar Paris, right past the King's Hotel. But the roadblocks were forcibly moved. Battles were fought, Jew against Jew. Police fired tear gas from the rooftops onto the demonstrators. The Knesset was pelted with stones. Windows were broken that allowed the tear gas to penetrate. And when the tear gas entered the Knesset, the windows shattered on some of the Mapam members of Knesset, someone cried out, "They're using gas! They're using gas against Jews!" And the riot broke out. Begin then entered the Knesset, and he began to speak, reading off a list of names of prominent Israelis, rabbonim, professors, secular, that opposed reparations. And Ben-Gurion interrupted him. "They are not identified with your hooligans in the street." To which Begin responded, "You are the hooligan." And he was removed from the rostrum. A riot again broke out. Begin saying, "If I don't speak, no one shall speak." The communist members of Knesset were also opposed, then cried out, "They're spilling blood, they're killing Jews in the streets." The Knesset was adjourned. Ben-Gurion called in the army to restore order. In all, 92 policemen were injured, along with 36 civilians. Hundreds were arrested, and the jail in Yerushalayim could not hold them all. I tracked down the front page of the Jerusalem Post. Here's the article from that day. It's the next day, January 8, 1952. 200 hurt as police defend Knesset from Chayrut riot. Of course, they were a leftist organ at the time, the Jerusalem Post. And it goes into the entire battle. It took 2 hours of violence in the streets before it was quelled. The debate in the Knesset lasted 3 days. When order was restored, Begin ascended the podium, apologized for calling Ben-Gurion a hooligan, but he said this matter would not die. And I continue, "There are things in life that are worse than death. For this we will give our lives. We will leave our families. We will say goodbye to our children, but there will be no negotiations with Germany. Today you have arrested hundreds. Perhaps you'll arrest thousands. We will sit together with them. If necessary, we will die together with them, but there'll be no reparations from Germany. Nations have gone to the barricades on less important issues." And Begin then waived his parliamentary immunity, subjecting himself to arrest. Ben-Gurion responded somewhat typically, inciting the people even more, going that night on the radio and saying, "Yesterday a dastardly hand was raised against the sovereignty of the Knesset, the beginning of the attempt to destroy democracy in Israel. Have no fear. The state possesses sufficient resources and means to protect Israel's sovereignty and freedom, and to prevent thugs and political assassins from taking control. The state of Israel will not be turned into Spain or Syria." Spain, of course, being a fascist dictatorship at the time, and Syria then, like now, an Arab dictatorship. Begin made one last appeal in the Knesset. Very interesting. I'll conclude my words with a number of comments to different groups. My first is to you, Mr. Ben-Gurion. Not as an adversary to an adversary. As adversaries, there's a chasm between us. There's no bridge. I turn to you as Jew to Jew. Have a referendum. Let the people vote. You don't have a majority in the Knesset. Even parts of your own party disagree. My second turn is to the Chavrei Knesset chosen by the Arabs, the Arab members of Knesset. He said, "Havchinu, distinguish bein zchut formalit lezchut musarit. Distinguish between a formal right and an ethical right. Zenyan shalanu. This is really our matter. You shouldn't vote. Tenu lanu lachria bekach. Let us decide. It's a Jewish issue. It's not an Arab issue. Pniyati ha-shlishit, my third, is to Charei Miflagat HaDatiyot, to the religious members of Knesset. Halachtem el ha'am b'vchirot b'shem Dat Yisrael. You went to the elections in the name of the religion of Israel, b'shem Tarat Yisrael, in the name of the Torah. Ma l'tarat Yisrael u'lamasa matan imam aleg. What does the Torah say about negotiations with Amalek? U'milchama l'ashem ba'amalek midardar. Just read it last Shabbos. Harei eshtakat al giyusan shel benot datiyot hitpalagtem. Last year in the debate over drafting women into the army, there you dissented from the government line. Va'al zeh lo timuchanim l'shivlo. And on this you won't dissent. What was the approach of the religious parties? It seems that most of them voted for it. I thank Debbie Sondheim for pointing out to me yesterday the commentary of Rav Zalman Saratskin, the Lutzke Rav. Zalman Saratskin was the son-in-law of Rav Lazer Gordon, the Telz Rosh Yeshiva. He was in Israel for the last 25 years or so of his life. Died 1966. He wrote his commentary on the Torah, Naim LaTorah, a year after this. It was published 1953. And he commented on the Pasuk in Bo, when Moshe told them, at God's command, God says to Moshe, Dabar na bozneh om, go tell the people, the Yishalu mer klei chesed v'klei zahav, go to the Egyptian homes and take the gold and silver, borrow them actually, take the gold and silver from Mitzrayim. So he asks, why does the Torah say, Dabar na, please, why wouldn't one want to go take the valuables of your oppressor? So Rashi says there, it's because God said take it, because God had to fulfill his promise to Avram Avinu, v'achrechen yetzu b'chush gadol. But of course the question is, why would they object to that? Why must they be asked, daber no, please do it? So he said there's no answer until last year, ad she'pershu b'hazman hazeh, until our times explicated it, when the question of shilumim, notice it was called shilumim, payment or compensation of pitzuyim. That's what the Israeli government termed it also, eskema shilumim. When the question of reparations in Germany, the curse of Germany for Jewish property came, and he quotes the two sided murderers, they killed 6 million of our brethren, and then when they were defeated, the question of payment to Am Yisrael for our property in Europe came, and the people were divided into two groups, some of them saying, should those who murdered us also be our heirs and keep our property? And the other side saying, that we should not negotiate with these evil people. Why should the nation say that we took ransom, blood money for our relatives? You killed them, but now you've paid us, and bygones are bygones. And he said that's a natural feeling that people should have. But nonetheless, you see, because even in Mitzrayim they would have that. They would say, why should we take anything from the Egyptians? Here they killed our children. They enslaved us. Just let us be gone. That's why God said no. Daber no. Take from them. We understand your hesitation, but I have to fulfill my promise to Avram Avinu. That's the no. That's the request. The please, please do it, even though the instinct is not to do it. Clearly, he linked the reparations from Egypt with the reparations from Germany. It seems that the religious parties could support it. Of course, not entirely analogous. For one thing, the money from Germany was going to the people who were enslaved. In other words, they're the ones who worked. It's not as if an entire sum of money were given to their ancestors or their descendants. It was actually going to them. So in that sense, it's really compensation for the labor that was given to them. Nonetheless, on January 9th, that's what he said, and that was the mindset of a good part of the people. On January 9th, 1952, the Knesset, by a vote of 61-50, with 5 abstentions, approved negotiations with Germany over Holocaust reparations. It was much closer than Ben-Gurion would have wanted. Begin was barred from the Knesset for 3 months for his actions, and he accepted his ban without protest. Around the same time, letter bombs were mailed to Konrad Adenauer. One exploded, killing a sapper. None reached Adenauer. 5 ex-Irgunists were arrested in Paris. In 2006, a few years ago, one of them published his memoirs posthumously, in which he stated that Begin was involved in forming the plot, although not in its execution. Interestingly, he wrote also that Begin was not against compensating survivors for their suffering. That was natural. Or even recovering Jewish property, which became more famous a little later on. He was against the Israeli government negotiating and taking most of the money. As a representative of the Jewish people, he felt that was morally reprehensible, that they should take money to which others were entitled. But Ben-Gurion saw the practical side. Whatever other arguments were made, they needed the money. In October 1952, Dov Shalansky, who was a Holocaust survivor and an Irgunist, also a survivor of the Altalena, he was arrested and charged with possession of explosives with intent to blow up the Knesset. He was sentenced to 21 months in prison. In an ironic twist of fate, Dov Shilansky became a lawyer and a politician, and in 1988 was elected Speaker of the Knesset that he had once tried to detonate. Jewish representatives led by Moshe Sharet and Nochum Goldman began negotiating with the Germans. It took 6 months to hammer out the Luxembourg Agreement, September 10, 1952. The agreement in Luxembourg was signed in a secret location because of the fear of violence. Sharet signed first with Adenauer. No speeches were made. At the end, they just shook hands in silence. Adenauer then signed a related agreement with Nachum Goldman on behalf of the Claims Conference. Germany agreed to pay $1.5 billion, today's equivalent, more than $13 billion, for the resettlement of Jewish survivors in Israel. And that was how they calculated, roughly $3,000 per survivor. But that money didn't go to the survivors, it went to the Israeli government. In essence, the money was paid to Israel, representing those Jews who had been murdered without heirs. Now, the Claims Conference also received about $110 million to distribute to Holocaust survivors across the world. The Israeli government kicked in some of the money they received as well, distributed to the victims living outside Israel and in Israel. The money was to be paid over 14 years. It was paid, and much more than that as well. In effect, it equaled the amount of money the government had received from other sources in the previous 4 years. That's how much money it was in context. In the end, both arguments resonated, and in fact, both were right, in a sense. The money to Israel, as you heard Professor Shapira say, was indispensable to its survival and growth. So much so, think about this, in 1957, a full 87.5% of the revenue of the Israeli government came from German reparations money. 87.5%. Begin shifted tactics. His opposition here and the Kastner trial as well mobilized his supporters. Next election, 1955, Herut almost doubled to 15 seats, became the second largest party in the 60s. Of course, Herut would merge with the General Zionists, forming Gachal, later Likud. Never again would he work outside the system like he did here. Even became part of the government for the first time before the Six-Day War. And as we know, 1977, the great Mapecha, the revolution, his party became the largest party, and he was elected prime minister. So were Begin's fears justified? The dishonor, the blood money, the expiation of the Germans. Well, the latter did happen. There's no doubt about that. The German people, especially the last 20, 30 years, uninvolved in the Holocaust, began to think that their nation had been punished enough, and therefore, at least some of them thought that. It's a reaction I sensed myself in Germany a few years ago. I was there for a conference in Nuremberg on the 50th anniversary of the Nuremberg trials, and I sensed, and people, even the Germans who came to speak, just evinced this attitude. They have no guilt about the Holocaust. They feel shame. Shame but no guilt. Shame that Germans could have perpetrated such horrors, but no guilt, because they didn't do anything. Think of how the average American feels about paying reparations to blacks for slavery, and divide that by a certain number. You can understand the German mentality today. It's a multiply, but divide it. That wasn't the feeling at the time. Most Germans, on some level, accept the obligation. I should add, you know, the money came entirely from West Germany, not from East Germany, which was under Soviet domination, and the Soviets maintained the Holocaust was a fascist act. Communists had nothing to do with that, and therefore, though communist Germans have no responsibility for the Holocaust as well, and there was a new round, we'll discuss in a moment, in the 90s, when there was reunification of the two Germanies to get some money out of East Germany as well, really more money out of the Germans. Most Germans accept the obligation, although, in fact, the reparations agreement passed the Bundestag by a very narrow margin. Again, after the war, there was denazification. The members of parliament, by and large, not Nazis. Many had been anti-Nazi, so why should they be paying for the sins of the very same people who also persecuted them in the 30s and 40s? But what became more troubling, and this Begin must have sensed, is that the claims did not end, and really have not ended. And the reparations agreement was amended and extended several times. By 1978, the Germans had paid more than 53 billion Deutschmark, far in excess of the original agreement. Then in the 1990s, Jews, Jewish organizations, but some individual Jews also, started suing individual German companies, Deutsche Bank, Siemens, Volkswagen, etc., that had used forced laborers. Even U.S. companies like IBM were sued also. Israel started pressuring the Germans for more money for Holocaust survivors living in dire poverty. And in fact, under an agreement reached in 2011, which is just a year and a half ago, the Germans are paying the Israelis 403 million euros through 2014 for home care and pensions for Holocaust survivors, close to $600 million, in addition to money paid in previous years. And as part of the deal, you see how uncomfortable this should make, it makes me, but maybe others as well, as part of that deal, Germany also threw in two free submarines for Israel and discounts on two warships that they sold to Israel as well. And yet, one of the embarrassments of life in Israel is the shoddy treatment of elderly Holocaust survivors, many of whom live in dire poverty. So where did all the money go? Well, a good part of German reparations just went to the Israeli government and did not make its way to the survivors. You saw it, built roads, built a national water carrier. Begin, in fact, said during the debate, they'll take the money and buy tractors for kibbutzim. Right? What did Margaret Thatcher say about socialism? It works until you run out of other people's money. Well, this was other people's money to underwrite a socialist government, and that's what they used it for. And that was not hidden even from the very beginning. But worse than that, there have been persistent scandals at the claims conference until today. Inflated salaries. I mean, the head of the claims conference today makes, I think, $450,000 per year. Perks to the officers. The conference sitting on more than $1.5 billion in assets, while elderly survivors starve or live without heat. These scandals have been extensively documented by Isi Liebler. Add to that, in 2010, a dozen employees of the claims conference were indicted for embezzling $42 million, and it underscores both a general problem and a particular problem. The general problem, as we know, is that Jewish organizations find it hard to go out of business. even when the purpose of their creation has long expired. If the claims conference, for example, liquidated their assets and went out of business, there'd be enough money to ensure that every Holocaust survivor today, of whom there are little over 100,000 remaining, but only a small percentage actually destitute, they'd be able to live out their lives in dignity. And yet they're sitting on all these assets that were meant for others, not to sit in a bank. That's the general problem. The particular problem, and I've been rebuked for saying this in the past, and I'm sure I'll be again, is that the lure of free money is seductive. And there are people, especially survivors, who feel they can never be repaid enough for their suffering, and I respect that. I understand that. At a certain point, though, to go to the well of guilt too often becomes unseemly, especially when almost 70 years have passed and the descendants of the descendants of the descendants of the Germans are no longer really alive or involved. As there are fewer survivors left, there are also fewer perpetrators left. So for how many generations will Germans be held responsible for the Holocaust, today's Germans? So we can say forever, and it's very natural, but that's from our perspective, it's a parochial perspective. Three generations removed from the Holocaust, it becomes a very difficult sell to the German people today and doesn't really bring honor to Jews. It's not that I feel sorry for the Germans, not at all. It's just that after 67 years after the Holocaust has ended, if we Jews cannot care for elderly survivors with our money, there's something wrong with us. And we shouldn't look to blame the Germans for that. If people have individual claims for property, then justice demands that they recover that. And I have no problem with that at all. I think that is justice. Justice also places a time limit on certain monetary claims. My wife will remember in maybe 96 or so, we were in Vienna for a few days visiting the Jewish Museum in Vienna, where they have a lot of the valuables stolen by the Nazis on display, Jewish valuables, and one of the things that was in a display case, I remember it vividly as if it happened this morning, was a silver bowl used for Machzah Shekel, and had a certain person's name on it. There's a woman in our group standing there looking at it, and she said, "That's my name." And then she remembered, she was born in the late 1930s in Austria, and not in Vienna, but a nearby village. And when she was born, her father donated a silver Machzah Shekel collection plate bowl to the shul, all right? That's the bowl her father gave to the shul. Had her name on it still. She turned white. She goes to the office and said, "That's my bowl." And she was greeted very coldly. They're not in the business of giving over their valuables to Jews, even to Jewish owners. So I think it ended there. But it was an eerie moment. It was her name and her date of birth and her bowl. But nonetheless, now it's in a museum. She can't recover it. If she could, so kol hakavod, I think they should. The same thing with the artwork. Artworks, paintings that Jews own that the Nazis looted, but as a collective, to keep going back to the same trough again and again, at a certain point, it just doesn't sit well anymore. We lay ourselves open to the charge that it's all about the money, and if you just give them enough money, then everything will go away. So whether true or not, and of course it's not true, but nonetheless, we are open to the charge, we do a disservice to the memory of the victims. That fear, so passionately and forcefully expressed by Menachem Begin, is real. And it still coexists very uneasily with Ben-Gurion's contention of Haratzachta v'gam Yerashta, that the murderers should not inherit our property. It's bad enough that they killed us. Both arguments still resonate and still echo in our ears all these decades later, still another legacy of the Holocaust. I thank you all very much. Next week, we'll look at the part 10, which will be the last before I'm off to Israel. Part 10 of Great Decisions, The Forgotten War, Sinai, 1956. Thank you all for coming.